Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 5th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be talking about the new book, The Constitution, and Introduction. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to proceed with something of an interview sort of format today with one person leading the conversation. That will be Professor Kevin C. Walsh. He's a professor at the University of Richmond School of Law. We're very pleased to have him with us today. I'll thank him in advance for his participation. He's going to introduce our other experts. They're going to have some exchanges between and among themselves, but ultimately, as always, we'll be looking to you for questions from the audience. So do be thinking of your questions for when we get to that part of the program. But for now, let me turn it over to Professor Walsh.
Well, thank you, Dean, and thank you, everyone, for participating in this conversation about a book that is officially out today. There's a lot one can say about the authors, but let me say this. Michael Stokes Paulson and Luke Paulson are father and son. Mike is a lawyer and a law professor. Luke is a software engineer and recent college graduate. And they're co-authors of a powerful new primer on the Constitution of the United States. This book bears a simple title, The Constitution, An Introduction. But the book itself is anything but simple. It actually goes quite deep into the Constitution and its history of interpretation, but it does that without dragging. It's relatively compact, 320-page book. It has two main parts. Each of those is five chapters long. So part one is the written Constitution. It covers how the Constitution was drafted and ratified, the framers' overall design, the powers of the three departments of government, the Constitution's treatment of slavery. This chapter is called The Constitution's Collusion with Evil, and then the enactment and meaning of the Bill of Rights. It then shifts over in part two. The title of that is Living the Constitution, an inversion of the phrase we hear often, the Living Constitution, which is an idea that Paulson and Paulson reject, at least in its most simplistic, popular version. And these five chapters cover the history of the Constitution's interpretation through five periods. They call these periods Infancy, which is 1790 to 1860, Crisis, 1860 to 1876, Betrayal, 1876 to 1936, Restoration, which takes us up to 1960, and then Controversy, which 1960 to the present times. And the title for that last chapter is The Modern Era of Judicial Activism. Now, I'd like to start actually right at the beginning of the book. The first sentence of the preface says this: our goal in this book is to provide a reasonably short, reader-friendly, intelligent introduction to the United States Constitution in all respects, its formation, its content, and the history of its interpretation. Now, in that reasonably short, reader-friendly, intelligent introduction, the word intelligent is italicized. Mike and Luke, what do you mean by intelligent in that part of the book?
Well, thanks, Kevin. I'll start. This is Mike Paulson. And I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for setting up this call, too, and you, Kevin, for moderating it. Intelligent. Actually, long ago when we first started this book, we had the slightly longer subtitle, the title being The Constitution, An Intelligent Introduction and Brief History, which is actually pretty descriptive of what we're trying to do. The word intelligent, we cut out the word intelligent as like too self-promoting in some ways. We, you know, hopefully that the book will speak for itself. But the idea was to have a smart book, but not a ponderous book, to be one that would correct lots of myths and errors, but that would still be accessible to ordinary readers. We found that there, on the one side, there are these very serious, sophisticated, scholarly, massively long treatments of the Constitution. There's some very good ones, those. But they're usually inaccessible to ordinary readers. Or, you know, even ordinary lawyers might not have the time to indulge in a 600 or 700 page tome on the Constitution. But on the other side, the shorter books on the Constitution, the things in the Citizen's Guide and People's Constitution, stuff like that, pamphlety sort of things, annotated constitutions, tended to be, along with school textbook treatments, pretty superficial and shoddy and perpetuate a lot of errors. So what we are trying to do is aim right between the goalposts and get something that would be smart book, but not full of legal jargon or doctrine. An accessible book, something that real people could read, not just lawyers, not just law professors, to actually get informed generally about the Constitution, its history, its interpretation, the meaning of its core provisions, but to try to do it right, to try and you know, bring sound information and some good analysis about the Constitution to a broader audience and not just lawyers and law professors.
Well, it seems like one of the sort of arresting features at the outset of the book is to say one of the goals is to prevent people from forming false notions about the Constitution, including about judicial review, about the Supreme Court as the exclusive interpreter of the Constitution, and the like. And that had me a little bit worried, actually, as I was leaving this morning. My daughter told me she just got 100 on her test on the Constitution, and I'm worried about what she's learning.
Uh-oh.
Luke, you know, what should we watch out for in the sort of shallower civics type treatments of the Constitution that this book corrects for?
Oh, thanks. That's a good question. Hi, by the way, I'm Luke. So one thing that I've taken away from this book that we should watch out for in the shallower style of history or civics writing is the idea that the way things work right now is the way they're supposed to work, or the way that things have happened through history is just the best way for them to have happened, or that we shouldn't change anything. One of the themes of our book is that people have gotten the Constitution wrong many times, and the Constitution has been wrong many times. And we have to come to terms with that and do our best to figure out what is a good way of interpreting the Constitution. How can we do our best with this document? And that's something that I haven't really seen civics or history textbooks being so concerned about.
Well, it's interesting to go all the way now to the end of the book. Right? So the book begins by saying here's some things that are missing in general understanding of the Constitution, and then having walked all the way through the history of the Constitution's interpretation, you have some lessons for the 21st century. But then it ends this way, which I'm curious about. It says the book ends incomplete. Because, quote, we the people of the United States, the owners of the Constitution, have not finished its story or finished arguing over the Constitution's interpretation. The next chapters are in the hands of the people whose Constitution it is, in the hands of ourselves and our posterity. And there's sort of a forward-looking element to this. And, Mike, I think your generation is essentially handing the Constitution on to Luke and his generation. And is it in better or worse condition than it was when it was handed on to you?
That is a great question. You know, I'm the old guy. I just turned 56, and Luke is the young guy, just turned 23. So I was born right at the end of Chapter 9 of our book and at the beginning of Chapter 10. As you said, Kevin, you know, the second half of the book sets forth the history of constitutional interpretation, divides it into these epochs. And Chapter 9 covers this period, sort of the middle of the 20th century, ending right about at 1959 or 1960. And we call that chapter Restoration. And we're kind of cheerleaders for some of the good things that the Supreme Court did during that period. It overruled a lot of past precedents where there had been judicial activism in an earlier era. It overruled segregation with President Brown versus Board of Education. It was, we think, a pretty good period. So about the time I'm born, I think not only the Constitution itself, but our stewardship of it was decently good. It was much improved from an earlier generation about 30-some years before. Where is it now? Have I left a better constitution as I start to walk off the stage with Luke than when it came? That's really kind of the theme of Chapter 10, which we call controversy, you know, the modern era of judicial activism. And I think there is a lot of room for criticizing how the Constitution has been interpreted in the modern era. Not everything that's been done has been bad. It can point to some, in this chapter, some areas in which the interpretation of the Constitution has really thrived. I think First Amendment free speech law has, in general, done a good job of effectuating the original understanding of the First Amendment. And actually, one area where I think the Constitution has made some progress in the past 50, 55 years is in interpreting the equal protection of the laws as forbidding government discrimination on the basis of sex outside of certain specified circumstances. I think that actually is consistent with the original meaning. But on the whole, the past 50 years have seen a turn to judicial activism that kind of replicates some of the worst things of other earlier eras in the court's history. I think of the court's activist decisions in areas like separation of powers, judicial incursion on commander-in-chief powers, narrowing of the free exercise of religion, at least over the past 25-some years. And, of course, it's become a new heyday of substantive due process, that wonderful oxymoronic word where the court takes general language of the Constitution, the Due Process Clause, and infuses it with whatever meaning it seems to think appropriate at the time. You know, in one era, pre-Civil War, that was the Dred Scott decision, finding a substantive due process right to own slaves in federal territory, notwithstanding Congress's prohibition. Then there was the Lochner era in the early part of the 20th century, where the courts used substantive due process to invalidate economic and regulatory legislation. Today, you know, all of your listeners know this. You know, the big controversial issues of today have been things like abortion, right to die, gay rights, where the court has, you know, whether one agrees with the policies or not, the court has basically taken language in the Constitution that doesn't create these rights and read into them the content they want in any specific situation. And one of the lessons that we hope just sort of emerges naturally from the book, we try to leave the specific conclusions to the readers. But one of the lessons is that the court does less well by the Constitution when it strays from the meaning of its words and starts going about on its own social policy activism. On that metric, I think we've left the Constitution to the next generation, at least in our interpretations of it, in worse shape than it was at the time that I was born. I think it's been a period of pretty much unrestrained judicial activism and assertions of judicial hegemony. That whatever this court says goes and binds everybody else, no matter how far off from the Constitution's text they actually go.
Well, that leads to one of the surprises, at least for me, in the book, because a book that begins by saying we have these myths, errors, and riddles or distortions that affect the way the Constitution is taught, the way that most people think about it, right? And a couple of those that you mention are the meaning of so it's not true. You say that the meaning of the Constitution's words evolves fluidly over time. It's not true that the history of the Constitution has been one of steady progression toward justice. And yet, there's a certain hopefulness in the coda that I found surprising. When we think about some of these big mistakes, like the idea that the Supreme Court itself invented judicial review, or that interpretation of the Constitution is exclusively for the courts, I guess maybe this is a question best asked for Luke. Why is there reason for hope that any of these things might be better understood, and that perceptions on some of these core things about who is responsible for interpreting the Constitution, why is there reason for hope that any of that may change?
Oh, there's reason for hope because of this book. No.
That's great.
Not just that, though. I think this is the way that people, average citizens, become engaged in the Constitution. And going back a little to the last question, I think the Constitution hasn't really gotten worse in the past 50 years. It hasn't gotten worse since maybe the 18th Amendment. But what has happened is people have become less interested, on average, in its interpretation. And that's connected with the fact that it's the Supreme Court that's taking over the interpretation, the not directly democratically elected branch of government. And I think one of the things we're trying to do with this book is show people that, no, the political process, the political branches, the president and Congress, and possibly even the states and the juries and citizens voting, I mean, those can be more controversial, but average citizens do have something meaningful to say about the Constitution's interpretation. And that's why we think it's important to make this an introduction for everyone, not just for legally minded people.
Kevin, let me jump in again. This is Mike Paulson. I think that's a great book, great point that Luke made. It's part of the purpose of our book is to really equip people with an understanding of the Constitution's original meaning, its history of interpretation, and to give people the knowledge base from which to form their own conclusions and to engage in constitutional debate. It is our premise that the Constitution isn't the exclusive province of just the courts, and we should all sit by and just see what they decide and do whatever they say. Rather, the Constitution is a document owned by we, the people, and all people, all citizens of the United States and all government actors have a role in interpreting and applying the Constitution in an effort to be faithful to the Constitution.
So let me then ask about a specific issue, right? Because in the last chapter of your book, it's not dispassionate, but it's by any means. But rather than offer your prescriptions or your best understanding for particular issues particular controversial issues, you try and lay out the different kinds of arguments. But let me take something like same-sex marriage, right? Big issue at the Supreme Court right now. And the goal of this book is not to tell people, okay, here's what you need to think about issue X, Y, or Z. But suppose you have a sort of smart generalist, non-legal reader. How would they be better equipped after reading this book to think about a particular issue, like the interaction of the Constitution and claim to same-sex marriage? How does that work?
Well, that's a great and an explosive question, Kevin. This is Mike Paulson, jumping in if I can. You're right. Chapter 10 was the hardest one for us to write because all through the book we are trying to call things straight. You know, we definitely take positions throughout history and on the meaning of constitutional provisions. And we throw some punches and hopefully in the right places. People don't get too bent out of shape if you say that Dred Scott was wrongly decided and an atrocious decision, et cetera, et cetera. When we got to the modern era on a lot of controversial issues. It was an effort to remain fair, but at the same time take positions, because we do ultimately want people to be equipped to see the arguments, understand the arguments, evaluate the arguments. We'll sometimes point them in the right direction or what we think is the right direction, but always leaving people the room to disagree and evaluate. You know, that was one of the things we wanted to do, is not have an ideologically hard-edged book, but at the same time take positions. So on the same-sex marriage issue, it's interesting what we do in our discussion of that, because the book went to bed before, obviously, these Supreme Court cases this year. And we pointed out that the court has, in the modern era, kind of been all over the place on this issue. At some point, rejecting the idea that there was a right of homosexual sexual relationships. That was a Bowers versus Hardwick case in 1986. And then overruling it in 2003 in Lawrence versus Texas, explicitly on a substantive due process / privacy / general right to liberty rationale that in many ways reprises centuries-old constitutional debates where the court was doing things like that with other subject matter areas. And it's sort of also interesting that Lawrence, the 2003 case, overrules Bowers versus Hardwick, the 1986 case, and explicitly rejects the idea that stare decisis, the idea of being held to a prior precedent, would be controlling, which is exactly the opposite of what they'd done a few years earlier in reaffirming Roe versus Wade, the abortion case, and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where they essentially relied on stare decisis to adhere to a decision that probably a majority of the justices thought were wrong. So there are a lot of things going on there. It's like looking at methodological issues, issues like how you interpret the Constitution, pointing out historical parallels, and in substantial part leaving readers free to make their evaluation. The case we end, I took a quick look at this before coming in. We end with the United States versus Windsor, the Windsor versus United States decision from just 2 years ago. And we point out the holding, how the rationale is kind of all over the place, but that it fits into this pattern of judicial activism where the specific constitutional provision at issue doesn't really end up seeming to be the most important focus for the justices of the Supreme Court, but more the policy or the social outcome that they wish to achieve. And it looks like we make a mild prediction, because we have to hedge our bets. The court hadn't even granted cert in the cases before now. Make a mild prediction that the logic of the court's reasoning will probably lead it to find a national right to same-sex marriage. So if I were a betting man, that's how I think the case would come out. But we don't tell people on that issue, at least, what we think the right answer is. But we sort of lay down a pattern or a framework through which they can evaluate those issues. And it does tend to point in certain directions, we think.
Well, it definitely one of the I don't know if it's quite a theme, but one of the senses that I get in reading the book is that there are areas where there is room for reasonable disagreement about the true correct meaning of the Constitution. And I guess one thing that I'm curious about in a co-authored work is sort of the unwritten stuff, the stuff that's unpublished that gets cut. Because perhaps the two of you couldn't agree on it, and I guess a question for Luke is, what's a big constitutional issue or issue of constitutional law that the two of you disagree on, and therefore we won't know about it except from this podcast.
I don't think there's any such big area that we disagreed on or that didn't make it into the book. I mean, I learned most of what I know about constitutional law from my dad. so maybe he's brainwashed me a little. as far as we have differences, I'd say I lean a little bit more, very slightly more, toward the libertarian interpretation of things. For example, I remember one discussion we had where I was not convinced that Wickard v. Filburn was right. That's a New Deal era case saying that regulating private use of wheat produced on a farm, I think it was, is necessary and proper to Congress's power to regulate commerce between states. So I was not persuaded by his reasoning there. But we did discuss it in the book, and I think we were fairly even-handed on that one.
Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, this is Mike jumping in. Without looking at the book, I think what I remember from that is we end up describing Wickard as about the high water mark in terms of how broadly the Commerce and Necessary and Proper Clause had been interpreted and how it was a sort of eyebrow-raising interpretation at the time. I don't remember if we disclose or take a position on it. I have to go back and read my own book. But I do know from recalling these discussions with Luke, and a lot of this just emerged over the course of 9 years. I mean, we wrote this as a summer vacation project starting when Luke was a freshman in high school. But I remember Luke having the initial reaction that Wickard versus Filburn's reasoning was just clearly absurd. And I probably am the one who was a little bit corrupted by constant exposure to these cases and teaching them over the course of years. And I actually accept the logic of a broad grant of power enabling Congress to do some things that might disagree with. So I think like on certain issues like scope of enumerated national powers, I lean just a little more Hamiltonian, so to speak, and Luke might be just slightly more Jeffersonian. I'm not even sure that's accurate. But
no, I'm not sure. Maybe that's not accurate anymore.
Maybe non-Jacksonian in terms of Robert Jackson.
Our discussions definitely adjusted each other's views on some issues or refined them in a great interactive way. The stuff that ended up on cutting room floor was, I think, more a function of length and depth. As listeners can judge just from this podcast, I go on and on and on and on. And I can talk about legal constitutional issues forever and want to get into the arcana of them. And, there's no limit to what I find interesting, and it was astonishingly helpful how having an intelligent novice, who eventually became a constitutional law sophisticate, reining me in and saying, that's not central, that's not crucial, that's not important, drop these 2 pages of writing, Dad. And, you know, but sometimes we had disputes about what was important to keep and what was less important to keep. But in terms of general approach, we were pretty close. And I don't think that either of us steamrolled the other in terms of the viewpoint. By the time Luke was in his late teens, you know, this, if a dad can say so, this is a smart whippersnapper. And if I was saying something that was too extravagant or pushing the envelope too hard, he is very able to push back and say, no, we should not be saying that. That's not quite correct, or that's not quite logically rigorous. So it was a great dynamic working relationship.
Well, it's an interesting –
let me add
– go ahead.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. But let me add one more thing. I just remembered like what one of the biggest disagreements between us was in editing, and one of the biggest things we left on the cutting room floor was the text of the Constitution itself. It isn't in the book. And I was saying, you don't need it. Everyone can find it online nowadays. So that was kind of an interesting discussion to have.
That's true. Well, I think just the concern of the publisher to keep the book's length small enough that it would be light, accessible. I mean, it comes in just over 300 pages. We had to make some tight cuts at the end, and so the Constitution itself is not in the book because it is a book about the Constitution. And so people who read this book should read it with, you know, have our book in one hand, hopefully, and the Constitution in the other.
Well, I believe, in fact, that's the advice, right, that Luke, you end your portion of the preface with, right? Read the Constitution
first.
And start there, and I guess you don't have to tell people where to find it because they know that they'll find it. Well, why don't we open this up to questions from others on the line? There's a couple of things I'd like to follow up on, but why don't we see if there's questions out there?
Sure thing. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you're in the audience, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you'd like to ask a question. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we wait to see who might ring in, let me make a quick commercial announcement. Our next scheduled telephone conference call is this Friday at 4 p.m. when we'll host a discussion of the just-decided case, Williams-Yulee versus Florida Bar Association. That's the case in which the Supreme Court upheld against a First Amendment challenge, the Florida Bar rule prohibiting direct solicitation of campaign funds by someone running in an election for a judgeship. That's Friday at 4 p.m. It's quite possible we add a teleforum between now and then, so do check the Federalist Society website for updates. Of course, today we're speaking about the book, The Constitution, An Introduction. That's its title. If you received a notice of today's call, you also received a link to the Amazon page for the book, so you can click on that to get to the Amazon page of the book. Also, it's available in bookstores as of today. One other thing I wanted to mention, Justice Alito took a great interest in this book and wrote a review for the Federalist Society's flagship publication, Engage. There is a link to that review as well in the notice you received to today's call. So I urge you to take a look at all of that. Again, today, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've just got two questions pending. Let's go to our first caller.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you fine. Go right ahead.
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello, I'm actually from the UK. I'm from abroad, and I'm a researcher in American law. My dissertation is about states' rights and, in particular, nullification. So my question is really about nullification. And do you think, the question is for Professor Paulsen, do you think that this interpretation of the Constitution by the states could justify at this point nullification? Could nullification be justified by your view of judicial interpretation by the states?
Can I ask a question of you to clarify the question? Are you saying, is a term you're using unification?
No, nullification. Right.
The question is about interposition and nullification?
Yes.
Oh, nullification. Okay, sorry for our American pronunciation of things. That's actually a great question. I mean, as Luke was explaining, one of the distinctive features of the book is the embrace of the idea of multiple constitutional interpreters. Not just the courts. The president has an independent power of constitutional interpretation within the sphere of his powers. Congress has an independent power of constitutional interpretation within the scope of its powers. And, you know, we justify that in terms of American separation of powers doctrine. And Madison and Hamilton and many others have embraced that. We also discuss the question of whether state, since state government officials have an independent province of constitutional interpretation. In other words, whether the logic of American constitutional federalism and the obligation of even state government officials to swear an oath to support the Constitution implies a parallel power or province legitimately of states to interpret the Constitution in ways that might differ from federal actors. Now, there have been good examples of that and bad examples of that in our nation's history. A good example early on, and this is in one of the earlier chapters about the history of the Constitution, history of the Constitution's interpretation, is Virginia and Kentucky adopting resolutions disapproving of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which we describe as pretty severe violations of the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment protection of freedom of speech. Virginia and Kentucky reacted to this by condemning the constitutionality of acts that were unconstitutional but had been upheld by or enacted by all three branches of the national government. And it's Madison and Jefferson defending a right of states to interpose and resist unconstitutional incursions by the national government. You know, that was a huge controversy in 1798, 99, and then in 1800. And we defend in principle the legitimacy of state interpretation of the Constitution at odds with the national Constitution. That really is, I think, the good lesson that should emerge from the Alien and Sedition Act controversies. But then we point out how, you know, that's problematic. You can take Madison's and Jefferson's words and distort them, and they were distorted by some in the South to justify a right of state sovereignty to defy the national government's interpretations of the Constitution. In other words, Jefferson especially can be read as embracing the supremacy of state interpretations of the Constitution. And that became a doctrine that led to Southern theories justifying secession, right? That the states were the supreme interpreters of the Constitution. Now, our view is a refined one, or at least we present this as an eminently defensible position, that states have a province and a right to interpret the Constitution, but they are not the supreme interpreters of the Constitution either, and that they have no more right to dictate to the national government than the national government to them. So there's always this tension, and you see historically in America instances in which the right of states to independently interpret the Constitution has been used for good or for ill, which if you think about it is a consequence of any theory you have of the Constitution being interpreted by more than one actor. Any actor can misfire in their interpretation of the Constitution. And we tend to come down gently on the side that that means you should not vest all power to interpret the Constitution in a single body. So, yeah, that is probably one of the more interesting and provocative assertions in the book, is the legitimacy of state independent constitutional interpretation.
Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, it looks like we lost our second question. So the lines are wide open. If you have a question, while we wait to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question, we do have another question now. So let's take another call.
Hi, this is Chris Green at Ole Miss. Happy to get a chance to meet both of you at Princeton last spring. I have a question about the role of tradition in constitutional interpretation, if you say much about that. So this would be, for instance, this would be one simple way to distinguish Lawrence in 2003, saying, you know, we're not going to have any more prosecutions for intimate sexual behavior, because those are very, very rare by then. That would, you know, but it'd be one simple way to distinguish that from the Obergefell thing, where, you know, majority of states still retain traditional marriage definitions, and you know it would be relevant for something like Craig versus Boren and sex discrimination. You know, the sex discrimination argument that Chief Justice Roberts was floating at the oral argument last week. Do you say much about that? Is Glucksberg just as bad as Lochner in your view? Because it's, you know, it says there's substantive due process.
Luke, do you want that, or should I start?
Oh, I can't answer that. I might jump in later.
Okay. Chris, good to hear from you. Chris Green is a nationally prominent constitutional law professor in Mississippi, and we've debated, I think, a couple of times at law schools across the nation. I think we last saw each other, well, at Princeton graduation, but also at San Diego, I think we debated these things.
Sort of from the audience at the Federalist Society event.
Right. You know, we do not discuss a lot about tradition as a separate mode of constitutional interpretation. Now, Luke, cut me off if I get too inside baseball and too boring here, but there is a strand of modern substantive due process discussion that talks about the attempts to accommodate the idea of substantive due process, but cabin it or limit it to only those court-discovered rights which accord with the nation's deeply entrenched traditions and history. My view, personally, and I don't think we say anything specific about the book, that is that that's just a different version of substantive due process. I know when I've taught it to law students, I sometimes jokingly refer to it as substantive due process light, right? One-third less substantive due process than the really aggressive, we can adopt any policy we want type of substantive due process. The general tenor of our discussion of these issues throughout history, you know, going back to Dred Scott, we're especially severe in condemning the Lochner line of cases, and then we have some choice words to say about abortion and substantive due process. The general tenor is that this is not consistent with the text of the Constitution. This is judicial invention. There are different versions of judicially invented atextual readings of the Constitution, and some of them might be a little worse than others, but in general, we don't distinguish it. I know even some of the more conservative justices on the Supreme Court, in order to accommodate past judicial precedent, you know, have embraced a more limited version of substantive due process. In a book that strives to be ultimately about the Constitution itself, I guess I'd have to say that we come down against it pure and simple, though pointing out how it's been a consistent recurrent theme in our nation's history of constitutional interpretation.
Yeah. If I can follow up.
I would add. Oh, sorry. Can I go
ahead?
Yeah. So this might not be exactly what the question was asking about, but one place in our book where we really do put an emphasis on tradition is the early presidency in Congress as a source of constitutional tradition and practice. So, for example, President Washington's administration setting a precedent of broad presidential power over foreign policy, with Washington's neutrality proclamation in the conflict between France and Britain, and also with the precedent Washington set that was eventually enshrined in the Constitution of only allowing himself two terms in office. And I think, I don't remember exactly, I think in the book we take a positive view of that and saying, yes, the Constitution doesn't necessarily mandate these interpretations, but they were established by Washington's administration, and they've worked out well. In general, I would agree, though, that we don't take a very positive view of precedent, in part because one of the themes of our book is that not everything in the Constitution's history has been right, and not everything in its history has been progress towards a better interpretation.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point, and while we're waiting to see if somebody else rings in, we do have another call. I was going to ask a question, but let me defer to the next caller.
Hello, Professor Paulson. John Eisenbow calling with the Oak Brook College of Law, an old friend from last time we saw each other, I think it was Cancun.
Hi, John. How are you? Could you speak up a little bit? I'm having trouble hearing.
We have a little phone trouble here, I think, but I just wanted to ask the question, would your book be suitable for either a text or a supplement for a law school constitutional law class?
Great question. The short answer is yes. People should buy the book. It's appropriate as a text, though we're not pitching it as a textbook. We really want this to reach all general readers. If you were using it in a law school course, it would probably serve as a companion to a casebook. I mean, casebooks are case after case after case after case. Sometimes interspersed with the editor's analysis and direction. I'm co-editor along with Michael McConnell, Steve Calabresi, and Sam Bray of a constitutional law casebook. This is more of a narrative, right? This is a story you can read about the Constitution that describes its origins. I mean, the first chapter is a constitutional convention. Its structure, that's the second chapter, its structure and core themes. Then we proceed with description of powers of the various branches of the government. In a certain sense, it is a narrative description of the Constitution and its original meaning before you start getting the cases. I have taught an undergraduate course where I've used a mixture of casebook and the early versions of chapters of this book to parallel it. And it's worked really quite well, I mean, at least for me. So, yeah, John, use the book. Assign it. Get people to buy it and read it.
Would it work well as a supplement to Kimia Compressor?
I didn't hear the end of your statement.
Would it work well as a supplement to Kimia Compressor? The American Constitutional Order.
I'm not familiar specifically, and I'm not even sure I heard you correctly, but it would work well, we would hope, as a supplement to many constitutional law texts for undergraduates, for law school. But what we're hoping is that it's a book that people could read whether they are lawyers, law students, or students or not. If I were using it for a law school course, it might be the sort of thing I would assign or strongly recommend as outside reading even before you get started, right? Just sort of a background of the Constitution, an overview of the whole schmear. So it can serve many functions that way.
This is Dean Reuter again. If you have a question in our audience, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. I just want to take a minute to agree with you, Professor Paulson. I feel like it would be a very helpful thing for somebody going to law school to read before they arrived at law school in particular. It contains sort of a breadth of information that I don't think you're going to get in any one law school class in today's law schools. That was my observation in any event. Looks like we do have another question from the audience, so let me turn back to the audience now.
Yes, hello. My name is Barbara Samuels, and I belong to an organization that works for freedom of religion. And one of the things that is most important to us is teaching people about the First Amendment and their freedoms and about the Constitution. And so we're really going back to some of the basics about the Constitution. And I'm wondering if your book would work for us to have I know you said it's 300 pages long, which sounds pretty long. So I'm wondering if it has maybe a guide at the beginning, or are you considering doing maybe a study guide to go with it so that we could use it in our classes more easily?
Barbara, I'm curious, what level of class are you talking?
Well, we're coming into churches and communities, and we're really teaching like a survey course, and so we would aim it at maybe a high school graduate level.
I think it would be perfect. It's obviously broader than just limited to First Amendment and religious
mm-hmm.
freedom. I mean, you know, if you were teaching specifically an adult education course about the Constitution's protections of religious liberty and freedom of speech, that's something we cover. We cover it in the chapter in the Bill of Rights, and then in the course of the chapters dealing with the Constitution's history, we deal with specific controversies. And, you know, there are little sections of First Amendment controversies, and there's a great index to the book that, you know, you can use to chop up, to identify the parts that are most specific to what you're trying to use. Part of my background, Barbara, is, you know, before becoming a law professor, I worked for the Center for Law and Religious Freedom of the Christian Legal Society and did religious freedom litigation. So First Amendment, free exercise of religion, establishment of religion, freedom of speech for religious persons and groups is part of my legal DNA. It's not all of what we cover in the book, but I would hope that you would find our discussion of those issues both informative, congenial, and suitably provocative at the times that it's good to be provocative.
Thank you. We'll have a look at it and hope that works, because we're gathering materials. We started to do this already. So there's a lot of interest in this because of all the controversy about the religious freedom issues and those that have been before the Supreme Court and are before the Supreme Court right now. And we find that as we're talking to people about the First Amendment and freedom of religion, they become very interested in the other freedoms and in the Constitution as a whole. So that's why we're putting together basically a survey-type course that might be 6 sessions, 90 minutes each.
Well, that's a terrific enterprise. I think we're on the same page, because that's part of what the objective of the book is to be a primer on the Constitution accessible to general readers, non-specialists, and hopefully interesting to lawyers too, that covers the full ambit of the Constitution.
And what we were originally planning to do with the book was a little bit more in the textbook direction, something that could be used for an advanced high school or introductory college course. I think the study guide that you mentioned is really a great idea. I mean, we don't have one now, but I could see that being a part of something we do in the future, right?
Uh-oh, Luke, are you suggesting we do yet more work on this book? It's been 10 years in the making.
I'm just
messing with it. Yeah, the hard part is over, yes.
Well, I just want to say, if a big part of your goal here is to engage the average citizen like we are doing, then the easier you make it for people to use your book, the more it will be used. Because we find, as we're doing this work for religious freedom, we find that we're out there working with grassroots, and we find that people are very busy, their attention span is short, and so we put things together. That's why I say the 90-minute sessions that we will do, that's about the max that you can get people to do. But if you spend that extra amount of work to make your book even more useful to the great, you know, the great mass of people like me who are not attorneys, then it's going to be so much more successful, in my opinion.
Well, that's a great suggestion, Barbara, and we thank you for it.
The title of the book, once again, is The Constitution, an Introduction. Again, a link to the book is available on the in the notice that you got of today's call. Of course, it's available to Amazon and at bookstores near you. Let's take another call. Looks like we've got one more question here. Go ahead, caller. You might caller might have muted your own telephone. If that's the case, you need to come off mute.
I congratulate you both on what sounds like a great project, and as long as the last caller is suggesting more work for you, I wanted to suggest a little more. We have a large number of native Spanish speakers in the United States that would benefit, I believe, from a deeper understanding of the Constitution, the kind of understanding your book aims to give. I would suggest that at some point a bilingual edition be produced and that would include the text of the Constitution in both languages. Maybe it would have to be an abbreviated one, but for use in teaching basic civics to particularly Latino immigrants that will be moving into the stream of politically active people, namely voting, in the next 20 years. I'd like your comments on that.
Luke, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. That does sound like a lot of work. I mean, that I think that's something that would be our publisher's call more than ours. But yeah, in principle, I think that's a good idea. I mean, this is the kind of book that we wouldn't think of being an international thing just because it's about the U.S. Constitution. But you're absolutely right that people who are not native English speakers and who maybe aren't good English speakers yet could certainly use something like this as an introduction to the Constitution. And it makes a decent introduction, I think, to American history and American civics. So, yeah.
Let me agree in part and disagree in part with my co-author, Luke. This is Mike again. I spent a week in Santiago, Chile this winter. It's a good time to be in South America when it's January in Minnesota. And I found in teaching a class to a broad range of Latin American students that there is actually enormous interest in the U.S. Constitution and understanding the U.S. Constitution. It's not yet on the drawing board, but I actually think that for people in other countries who were looking for a book like, you know, okay, tell me what the core is of the U.S. Constitution, what its principles are, what it's, you know, demystify this a little for us, that it might be something that be very much of use abroad. You know, we had a UK speaker call in, and I think there's a huge Latin American potential market and interest. We'd love to see it. You'd have to change the name for the international edition, because right now it's just called The Constitution, an Introduction, and that's pretty parochial, as if the U.S. Constitution is the only one there is. But that's a simple fix, and sure, if we can share some of these ideas with the rest of the world, I mean, that's part of what has been the great accomplishment of the U.S. Constitution itself. It's the longest enduring written national constitution there is, and it's served as a model, highly successful model, for many younger constitutional republics.
Well, gentlemen, I think we've exhausted the questions from the audience. Professor Walsh, do you have a final thought or a wrapping up remark you wanted to make?
Well, I just very briefly on the this as a teaching tool and as a learning tool. In some ways, there's different audiences, and I think one of the challenges for law students is unlearning some of the things, and I think this book can be useful for that, and as well as then for new people who are learning things. I learned a lot myself from reading it, and I just want to thank our co-authors, Mike Paulson and Luke Paulson, for their time and for this fantastic accomplishment.
Well, thank you, Kevin, and thank you, Dean, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting us.
Of course, it's been our pleasure. To our audience, let me remind you about our next upcoming scheduled telephone conference call Friday at 4 p.m. We'll reconvene with the Williams Uli versus Florida Bar Association teleforum. We might have a teleforum in the interim, so please do check our website. My thanks, of course, to the Paulsons, both of them, and Professor Kevin Walsh for moderating and leading the discussion today. Of course, I want to thank the audience and invite you to join that next teleforum call. But until that call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.